From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Cokine. As we turn the calendar pages from 2016 to 2017, we look back at some of the most interesting topics Carolina Journal Radio has tackled during the past year. Free speech has faced a number of challenges in recent years on college campuses. We chat with a higher education watchdog. He shares his concerns about recent trends in campus free speech. One of the most pervasive public policy arguments involves the minimum wage. You'll learn why one of North Carolina's veteran political observers opposes plans to boost that government-mandated wage. If you've never heard of an EMP attack, you'll want to hear our conversation with a national defense expert. He explains why an electromagnetic pulse could prove catastrophic. Plus, we'll talk about efforts to fight overcriminalization in North Carolina. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Higher incomes, better health care, safer neighborhoods. Virtually all of us would like to see those goals achieved, of course. But while we may want the same things, conservatives and libertarians and progressives go about getting there in very, very different ways. The John Locke Foundation's Dr. Roy Cordato has been looking at the unifying themes of progressivism. He joins me now to talk about that. Roy, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be back, Donna.
What is progressivism? I mean, the word itself sounds pretty forward-thinking.
Yeah, well, and in recent years, liberals have been wanting to use the word progressive instead of liberal. And I think that's a great idea. Because they really do harken back to the progressive movement of the early 20th century. I don't like them using the word liberal because the root of the word liberal is liberty, which I happen to like.
So you would be a classic liberal.
Yes.
As liberal as it's used today.
Right. So I actually prefer to call them what they want to be called, which is progressives, because it recognizes their history, which is in the early 20th century, it was a history of basically using the state to control the economy. It gave us the ideas that ultimately led to Hitler and Mussolini and fascism. I think it's good for them to use that word. And what I argue in this paper is that the root of what coheres all of that together is the use of coercion and force through the state to achieve goals.
How so?
Well, if you think of modern day progressives, I mean, tends to be the case that they want the things that the rest of us want, right? Better health care, safer streets, and so on and so on. I think what makes it different is libertarians, conservatives, people like myself, we search for ways to accomplish those goals that are consistent with liberty, that keeps people free and that frees markets, where their unifying theme is they always go for a solution that involves government coercion, no matter what the case is. It's really hard to find an example where they embrace a solution that does not involve government coercion. And when they do, they usually are considered to be going off the reservation, right? To be acting conservative or libertarian in that position. So what I argue in this paper is, and people don't generally recognize it, is the unifying theme of progressivism is not what they want to accomplish. We all want to accomplish good things. And I'm not going to impugn their motives. But it's how we want to accomplish them.
Is it fair to say, Roy, that the unifying theme there is using government to force people or business people or individuals to do things they may not want to do and should have the choice to choose, yes or no?
Yeah, and that's what I mean by coercion. Telling people what to do through with their property and with themselves and preventing people from pursuing life, liberty, and happiness, right?
That sounds familiar. Let's talk about how this manifests itself in some particular instances mm-hmm. of public policy. You write in your paper that minimum wage mandates are a great example of this. Explain that.
Well, look, we all want lower income people to have higher wages, right? Certainly I do. And we don't differ on that goal. Right. So, but when they see a problem like that, they say, well, you know, people should have a living wage. They make these arguments that it's just $7.25. The current minimum wage is just too low for anyone, to make it by on. And so their solution is, well, just force employers to pay more. And if you don't, you get heavily fined go to jail even if you refuse to pay the fines. Where someone like myself, a libertarian economist, would say, look, there are ways consistent with freedom to accomplish that same goal, and that is not harmful because the minimum wage and it prevents people from working. If you're not worth the minimum wage, you don't get employed. So there are ways consistent with voluntarism to get people to earn more money, better education, apprenticeship programs. I mentioned in there, actually, you want somebody to have higher pay, exempt them from Social Security, right? That doesn't affect the market. It allows them to keep more of what they earn.
Or an employer could voluntarily choose to pay whatever hourly wage they wanted to if they felt it was worth it to them.
Oh yeah, of course. Well, the idea is to make that employee worth more, so the employer wants to pay them more, or in fact must pay them more. He never wants to pay them more, but if an employee is worth more, that means he has other options. He can, if an employer isn't paying as much as he's actually worth in the marketplace, he can go out and get a job somewhere else. That someone who is willing to pay. So, look, no employer wants to pay more than he has to for a worker or for anything else, for that matter. But it's marketplace and competition. So, what you want to do is make workers more competitive in the marketplace, and you don't do that through force by saying, "Well, you have to be paid more." Well, it's really you have to be paid more or nothing at all, which is the choice that an employer faces.
Now, you also write that we're seeing the progressive approach in Obamacare.
Sure. Another great example. Look, we want there to be more people insured, right? We want better health care and so on. But when they look at a problem like, well, there's not enough people who are getting health insurance, what's their solution? Well, let's have a law that says that everyone has to get health insurance, and all employers have to provide it. And if you work for yourself, you have to buy it or face stiff fines. That's their solution. It's the force, the coercive solution. Of course, free market economists, health policy analysts on the conservative libertarian side says, yes, we want more people to be insured too. But how can you do that? Well, get rid of regulations that cause health insurance to cost more. Get rid of regulations that causes healthcare, like certificate of need laws, for example, that cause healthcare to cost more. So you can, affect the same solution, which we all want, but through non-coercive means. They always take the coercive route is the argument I make.
Roy, some would argue that progressivism is growing in popularity mm-hmm. in this country. Why?
That's a good question. I think it's because it's easy. I mean, the fact is that state coercion is easy. You don't like something? Well, what's the first thing? There should be a law, right? I mean, this is how we've come to think, which is unfortunate, that if you want something to be different, you just pass a law to to force it to be different. And that's a very appealing to people. You have to actually think through free market solutions to understand them.
We've been talking with Dr. Roy Cordato, and we're talking about the piece that he has written, which you can find at carolinajournal.com or johnlock.org. Dr. Roy Cordato, thanks so much.
Sure.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. With students back on college campuses in North Carolina and across the country, now seems like a good time to review the current state of free speech on those campuses. Joining us with expert insight is Robert Shibley. He's executive director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, also known as FIRE. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
We've had you on this program before, and one of the main topics has been speech codes on campuses. Let's talk about that first. How do things stand in terms of the actual policies on these campuses that limit when, where, and how students can speak?
Well, the good news is that in terms of actual policies, there are fewer speech codes on campus now than there have been since we started measuring 7 or 8 years ago. In fact, for the first time last year, the number of speech – okay, so we rate speech codes at 440 of the largest and most prestigious universities in America, and we re-rate those every year. And this last year was the first time that the percentage of red light speech codes, those are the very worst speech codes, we give them a red light, dropped below 50%. It was 49.9%, but it was below 50 for the first time. It was 75 the first year we were measuring. So there's definitely been progress along those lines. Unfortunately, most of the schools that are remaining are not green light schools, the best schools, schools with no speech codes at all, but rather yellow light schools, which are schools that have speech codes that can too easily be used to abuse free speech on campus, but which aren't as laughably unconstitutional or as laughably against the principles of free speech as red light speech codes.
The North Carolina schools compare favorably, or are we doing better or worse than the nation as a whole?
North Carolina is actually doing a little bit better than the nation as a whole, and has one of the more recent conversions to green light in the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, which just last year became a green light school. And there's only, I think there's less than 25 of those in the nation. So that's actually a really good distinction. And we were, we worked with UNC for a long time to get them there. I wish the rest of the system would do that too. But so far that hasn't been the case.
Well, some relatively good news then on speech codes, but that isn't the only way that universities across the country are seeing some attacks on free speech. We've seen lots of cases in the news. Harvard, Yale, University of Missouri, sometimes even the attacks are not coming from the university itself, but from professors or even students. What are some of the main things that are striking you right now as red flags dealing with speech on campuses?
Well, one of the real red flags that developed last year was an increase in hostility and invisible hostility towards free speech from students, like you said, an increasing number of students who seemed dead set against free speech in a number of ways. Some would ban press members from members of the press from attending their protests. There were some that flatly said that certain people weren't welcome at their protests. There were protests against free speech itself, and the idea against free speech probably most prominently at Harvard Law School. So this is the first free speech is beginning to be made a scapegoat for the other problems that campuses have. And that's something that, of course, FIRE wants to push back on, because free speech is a solution to the problem, not the problem.
We are speaking with Robert Shibley. He is executive director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, also known as FIRE. This has to be particularly disturbing. I mean, it's one thing for the campus officials who don't like people complaining about what they're doing or saying bad things about them to get up in arms and try to limit that. It's another thing for the students themselves to not want to engage in debate. That has to be of a special concern.
It is. It's a huge concern. And unfortunately, you know, from what we can tell, you know, obviously colleges and universities are encouraging this kind of behavior by not only rewarding people who, you know, want to censor each other by agreeing to do it and by, you know, sending the wrong messages, which they've been doing for decades about free speech. But frankly, students are coming into college with this idea that speech is something that's dangerous, something that should be limited, and something that the authorities should limit, even when it's them saying it. That is kind of a new development. It seems like, you know, a switch has kind of flipped in the last probably not more than 2 or 3 years. And whatever that's coming from, whether it's simply a cultural shift or whether it's something that's changed in K-12 education, it's certainly been a really disturbing development to see. Students used to be the most reliable advocates of their own rights. After all, it's their skin in the game. And unfortunately, that's less true than it has been. Obviously, you don't want to overstate the case, but I think a lot of the students who do support free speech, who support due process, who support, you know, the traditional rights that Americans enjoy, are being shouted down and basically shamed by people who want to blame the existence of these rights. You know, they want to blame other problems on the fact that these rights are out there, the very rights that make it possible for people to know about the problems they're talking about and to express their disapproval of it.
You work for a group that spends much of its time on the issues regarding free speech. So if we have this new problem, this flip being switched, as you mentioned, what do we do about it?
Well, you know, one thing that FIRE is doing is we are going further towards education efforts. We want to try to reach into the K-12 area educationally. We're not going to begin taking cases from high school students who are censored anytime soon. FIRE has always been focused on higher ed, but the fact is, if the group of people coming into higher ed don't believe in free speech, there's only so much that you can do to try to protect it, to try to defend it. So we need to be able to get to students earlier, and so we're working on ways to do that. We are also working on litigation that would help to further those goals because thankfully the court still largely supports free speech.
What happens to our campuses if we lose this support for free speech? What's going to be the downside for those who are listening and going, well, that sounds bad, but hey, I'm not on a college campus. I don't have to worry about it.
Well, the huge downside, and it's going to be a visible downside, is that the wheels of progress are going to grind to a stop. And I don't just mean the wheel of social progress. It's just how a lot of people think of progress. But the fact is, this attitude is bleeding over into the sciences. It bleeds over into not just the social sciences, but also the hard sciences and a whole variety of different topics. You're going to start to see colleges be far less productive. You're going to see colleges get a reputation for not being places where people can do clear thinking, where the things that are not popular, I mean, you know, there are things that are unpopular with physicists or biologists or whatever. They may be right. They may be wrong. We have no idea. But if you have a culture where it's common to, you know, to try to silence the opposition, if the opposition turns out to be right, you will literally stop the advance of science. And that's going to be noticeable. And what's going to happen then is a huge decrease in the confidence that Americans have in institutions of higher education. You're going to see a decrease in funding, a decrease in popularity, and it's going to be quite visible. College is going to start to become considered a joke in many ways. And unfortunately, that's going to happen faster, I think, than a lot of people believe, and certainly faster than colleges believe. They believe that they can, you know, consistently disregard and ignore these rights and nothing bad will happen. And they're wrong about that.
Our time remaining is short, but if there's a college student out there listening or the parent of a college student, someone who works at a college and says, wait a minute, I know about some problems, and this sounds like someone who might be able to help me. How could someone get in touch with FIRE to share their concerns?
The best way is to check out our website at thefire.org. THEFIRE.org, and you can submit a case or question on that website. We handle hundreds of them a year. It goes up every year, and we're happy to talk to you and give you advice.
Robert Shibley, he is Executive Director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Robert, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The nature of work is changing around the world, in the United States, and in North Carolina. North Carolina State University's Institute for Emerging Issues recently held a forum focusing on the future of work. One panelist, John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood. Moderator Tim Boyum gave Hood an opportunity to take on a popular myth about work. It's the notion that our state would benefit from a higher government-mandated minimum wage.
If high wages and low wages continue, and there's a big gap in between, do we need to examine the issue of minimum wage, particularly as we think about future work and jobs that could exist in the future?
This is a well-plowed field. Every time a little sprout comes up, we plow it back over. The debate's been going on for decades. My own view is that raising the minimum wage is the worst possibly tailored plan if you're trying to address people who are low income. People who work at minimum wage are not necessarily the people who are poor. Most of the people who are poor for chronic lengthy periods of time, they're not working full-time at any wage. They're working part-time or not at all. So we want to create jobs. We want to create opportunities to move up to the next level. There are people who support themselves and families on minimum wage or shortly or higher, somewhat higher than minimum wage, but there are also lots of people who work at minimum wage who are not in that situation, who are getting their first job. They're 16, they're 17, they're 18, they're 19. They don't come from low-income families. So getting economic opportunity right, creating opportunities for higher-paying jobs, is distinguishable from whether to raise the minimum wage. Now, some conservatives do panic too much about minimum wage increases and suggest all sorts of, you know, gigantic, horrible things that will happen in the labor market. The truth is that the number of jobs affected by the minimum wage is pretty small. So the effects, positive or negative, are relatively small in the whole scheme of things. The real issue is putting capital in the hands of workers. Capital is what makes labor more valuable, which leads to labor being more highly paid. Capital can be physical capital, it can be tools and equipment, but mostly now it's human capital. It's what's in your head and what you're capable of doing with your hands. To the extent that we improve education, to the extent that we incentivize capital investment of all kinds, wages will rise. And the minimum wage will be a fairly minor part of the story, whatever you think of it.
That's John Locke Foundation Chairman John Hood. He's explaining to the audience at NC State University's Emerging Issues Forum why a higher minimum wage is not the answer to improving the state's economy. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to the Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. If you haven't spent much time thinking about the potential danger of an electromagnetic pulse, or EMP, our next guest hopes to change that situation. Dr. James Carafano is Vice President for Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So EMP, people may have heard that term, and many of them don't know what it is. So what is it?
Right. So there's two reasons why people should worry about it. One is because it could happen. And the other is if it does, what it might do. So electromagnetic pulse is exactly what it sounds like. It is a flush of electromagnetic energy. And if it's high enough, it's massive, much like when you had a flood of water go into your plumbing system in your house, your pipes are going to burst. If you had a flood of electromagnetic energy, it potentially could short out electrical systems. So how do you get a big, giant, massive pulse of electromagnetic energy that might change the way we live? And there's two ways. One is you can detonate a nuclear weapon. We know that how that happens because we did nuclear tests back in the day, and some of them were airburst tests. And when we did the airburst test, we discovered that when you do most nuclear weapons for military use, it was called a low airburst, right? So you detonate it close to the ground. And the reason why you do that is you want the maximum amount of energy to touch the earth where your target is, right? So if the electromagnetic pulse, which was generated by a nuclear weapon, if it might affect an electrical system, you wouldn't notice because the other effects of the nuclear weapon would melt it or blow it up or destroy it. So what happens when you detonate the weapon in the atmosphere or in space? Well, what happens is the physical energy, the explosion, the fires that result, that dissipates, of course, but nothing stops the electromagnetic energy. So it blossoms and it's line of sight. So it just keeps going until it touches something. And like all forms of electric energy, like think of lightning, right? It's going to be attracted to an electrical system. And if it's a massive amount of energy, it it could burn out that system. And we discovered this when we had these nuclear tests, and the lights in Hawaii started to dim, and the monitoring systems kind of went crazy. So an enemy could detonate one large nuclear weapon over the United States and potentially take out the entire electrical grid. Now, the other way that could potentially happen is something called space weather, which is a wacky term, but that's what the scientists call it. And that is the solar flares that are kicked out by the sun. And we've all heard about or seen about that. You know, sometimes maybe your cell phone goes a little wacky, or your TV antenna goes a little crazy, or they say airplanes may be having a little problem communicating or something. But what happens if you have a massive solar flare? And these occur on intervals of around hundreds of years. And that would look very much like the massive flood of electrons that would come out from a nuclear weapon, but it's generated by the sun. We haven't had one of those since the turn of the 19th century, and nobody cared in the turn of the 19th century because there weren't many electrical systems. But if it happened today, you would have this massive thing. So what's the problem there? And the fundamental problem is the loss of the electrical grid. If you lose the U.S. electrical grid, that is a life-changing experience that nobody has experienced in our lifetime. We actually did some research because nothing like that's ever happened. So we tried to mimic that would do by understanding what other kinds of disasters. So we looked at large-scale blackouts in cities. We looked at large-scale weather events that take out infrastructure, earthquakes, and trying to understand that and then scale that if you had a weapon that was big enough to cover the entire United States and Canada, or if you had a massive solar flare, which could potentially cover an entire hemisphere. And the one thing we discovered is the one thing the United States can't survive is the loss of its electrical grid. By some estimates, 90% of Americans will die. And that seems weird, I think, to people because, okay, so let's say the grid burns out. What's the big deal? Well, there's no transportation networks. There's no communication networks. Hospitals don't work. People can't keep their diabetes chill, insulin for diabetes. So the loss of medical care, the loss of heating and cooling systems, the loss of transportation systems, they think about 90% of America would die or die of exposure or hunger or disease within a year. So when it's all said and done, is it a likely event? Well, there's no way to predict probability for that. We know someday there will be a massive solar flare. We know that the technology already exists to deliver a weapon like that. So it's possible. Nobody can give you odds. But here's what we can say. It's arguably maybe the only thing which could affect the United States, which is actually truly genocidal, right? We have 330 million Americans, 90% of them dying. There's very, very few other threats that could happen in our lifetimes, which might equal that. So that's why it may be something worth being concerned about.
That is the voice of Dr. James Carafano, Vice President for Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. So it sounds awfully scary. 90% of the population could die because of one of these things. But there is something that we can do to help prevent the damage, right?
Sure. I mean, well, there's two things, right? One is in order to have an EMP effect on a large scale covering a massive geographic area, that's line of sight, right? So how do you get line of sight to geography? You get very high. If you're very high, you're looking over the mountains and everything else, right? So you want to detonate a nuclear weapon, what's called at apogee, which is when it's at the high point of its trajectory, right? So it radiates downward and you want a very big nuclear weapon. So one way to deal with that is to shoot the missile down before it detonates, right? So missile defense, which is a kind of a multi-purpose protection. I mean, the missile defense doesn't care if somebody's shooting a missile at Los Angeles or they're doing an MP strike to take out the U.S. electrical grid. The missile defense is just going to shoot the damn thing down. So I think comprehensive missile defense is a kind of a one-stop solution for that type of EMP genocidal threat. Then you get to the solar flare question. We're not going to shoot the sun down. There's a couple of things we could do, though. One is early warning. Even light isn't instantaneous, right? And electromagnetic energy has to travel here, and that's going to take on the order of 30 minutes or more. And so if you have adequate early warning systems of your space weather event and you understand the scale and the thing, there are some mitigating effects you could take to mitigate the threat, right? You could shut stuff off, right? Because if a electrical current system, if it isn't operating, right, it's not going to attract an electromagnetic charge. There might be some other mitigating effects you could take in your infrastructure to ensure that you could start up again. The key thing is you have to be able to turn the electrical grid back on. You could have an outage of a couple hours and days. I mean, we've all experienced that. I mean, outages that maybe last 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, storms, the world. Hurricanes.
But you have to be able to get the national. When I say the national grid, you know, if you're a Canadian, dude, you're screwed, right? Because it's actually an American Canadian electrical grid. So anything that happens to us on our grid is going to happen to Canada. So it's actually a joint problem between the U.S. and Canada. But you can't have the grid be out for more than a couple of days. Certainly not on a large scale. So that means you have to have some way to mitigate the effects of that. And I think that's where the debate is get the right cost benefit. What's the right combination of mitigation techniques that you want to use to protect against solar flares? And then I think you know we should be moving rapidly towards comprehensive national missile defense because there are, I think, increasingly more states with long range weapons and nuclear weapons that can reach us. And I just don't think a genocidal attack is something that we should leave on the table.
Well, as the debate moves forward, we at least want people to know that there is a debate and that they should be paying attention to the electromagnetic pulse and the threat of an EMP attack or the solar flares. Dr. James Carafano is Vice President for Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. It's called over-criminalization. Now, that's a term applied to the many rules and regulations that are now actually treated as crimes in North Carolina's criminal code. The effort to remove these crimes from state law is growing, with support crossing ideological lines left, center, and right, and it includes, at the forefront of this movement, the John Locke Foundation. Becky Gray is Vice President for Outreach. She's here to explain exactly what this is all about. Becky, welcome back.
Thank you.
When we use the word crime or the phrase criminal code, I think a lot of us think, well, robbing a bank, stealing a car, that's a crime. But what we're talking about here is a bit different. Help us understand it.
Well, you have to kind of go back and look at this. Our criminal code has grown just tremendously over the last several years, and that's for a variety of reasons. One thing that you have to think about, what do legislators do? They legislate. So they pass rules, they pass regulations. You know, we hear so many times of injustices, and someone says, well, that ought to be a crime. So what the General Assembly often does is they make it a crime. So, you know, this criminal code has grown and grown and grown, and what we've seen is a lot of things that really are in the line of people conducting personal business or business that has become written into the criminal code. So this is an effort nationally. It's not just in North Carolina. There's an effort at the national level, but there's also an effort at the state level. And North Carolina has been getting some attention for this, number one, because we now have an environment of a legislature and a governor who are interested in making government work better, be fair, open up more opportunities for people. But also North Carolina's criminal code has grown tremendously. So it's bringing some common sense to it. One of the real problems with this is often these crimes or these actions become crimes, and part of the deal with it is the person that is committing this doesn't have any responsibility to have any intent or even to know about the criminal code. And so they call that in legal terms mens rea. And so there's an effort to avoid, you know, to pull back some of this. If you do something totally inadvertently, you know, with no intent to break a law unknowingly, that perhaps we need to look at that in a different way and pull those things out of the criminal code.
I know that one of the concerns with the growth of the criminal code in particular has to do with people who may be operating small businesses or big businesses,
exactly,
for that matter.
Right.
But if you're a small business owner or manager, Becky, you're going about your business every day just trying to sell your product or your service, and there's all sorts of rules and regulations you have to keep track of, and it can become overwhelming. Are you saying then if someone in that situation inadvertently breaks a rule from some state board, they could actually be charged with a crime?
That is exactly right, with pretty hefty monetary penalties. And in some cases, even jail time is included in that. So, you know, as you mentioned, small businesses are going about their business of creating their business and
right,
making that
trying
grow.
To be successful.
Big businesses have teams of lawyers whose job it is to monitor the federal criminal code, the state criminal code, so that when changes are made, they're on top of all of that. Small businesses don't have the resources to do that. So it limits their ability to grow. It limits their opportunity. You know, if you're trying to start a business and don't have the funds to hire big, expensive, high-powered attorneys to monitor all of those things, just the threat that you might do something that is a crime, that is against the law, is a deterrent in itself for you to pursue those opportunities. So that's where individuals, many low-income individuals and small businesses, not the big high-powered entrepreneurs that you hear about, but, you know, people, it's sort of everyday people, are deterred from starting their business because of this over-criminalization.
I would certainly think twice, because I've never really thought about it in those terms. I'd be thinking about, you know, can I hire someone to help me? Can I make my service better? Can I get more customers?
How do I make my investment pay off,
right,
as a business, not, you know, with defending yourself against unknown activity that, you know, you may commit a crime you're not even aware of.
Becky, this is one of these issues where the John Locke Foundation has really been leading the effort.
Right.
For more than a year now, we've been writing about it. You've been talking about it. You travel across the state. And when you talk about this to people who may live in Western North Carolina or along the coast, are folks even aware that this is an issue?
Probably everyday folks are not, until they run into it. You know, if you're a small business owner, or you're someone trying to conduct your business, you're unaware of it until somebody shows up at your door
and says,
hey, you broke the law.
Right.
But let me tell you where we're really getting the traction on it and the interest, and that is with members of the General Assembly. You mentioned the Locke Foundation has been at the forefront of this. It has been for several years that we have done this. We have some national partners. Some folks at the Manhattan Institute have written a lot about this, specifically about North Carolina. And a couple years ago, we were down and visited probably a dozen lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, some very veteran lawmakers, some new lawmakers, mostly attorneys because they're familiar with this. And Donna, I will tell you, the response that we got to do something about this was overwhelming. And some of the most left-leaning Democrat leadership were sort of at the forefront of, I would welcome the opportunity to help you with this. This is something that needs to be done. Everyone recognizes the need for it. It's not a partisan issue at all. So I am very helpful. And actually, we have introduced at the General Assembly in every year in sort of different formats, but the thought of a task force to go in and look at this. Now, this is one of those things that needs to be done thoughtfully. You know, you can't just go in and, you know, you and I can't sit at the table with a red pen and say, well, this doesn't make sense. We're going to cross this out, because there's unintended consequences, and you don't want to cross that line of, as you mentioned at the beginning of this segment, you know, we don't want to make it okay that you can break into somebody's house and steal stuff.
Right.
You know, you want to make sure that it's as thoughtfully undone as it has unthoughtfully been done. So we're talking about setting up a task force, having some really thoughtful people, having some judges, some attorneys, some business owners be part of that, so we can begin to look at that and very thoughtfully unravel this criminal code and bring some sense to it and bring some opportunity back to North Carolinians, rather than this, you know, uneven, threatening system that we have now.
It's pretty interesting because as you're describing what the recommendation is, and hopefully this task force will come to fruition, but the Locke Foundation has been very successful on what I would call almost a parallel track in terms of rules and regulations,
yes,
about talking for years about the negative impact on people and businesses. And we've been really successful now in moving that idea forward and having a lot of those things scrutinized like they've never been scrutinized before.
And those, the rules and regulations that you're talking about, are really the fiscal impact that those rules and regulations have on businesses and opportunity. With this over-criminalization, it's really a loss of freedom with this and the threat of freedom. And yes, in many cases, there are monetary penalties with this. But, you know, when you're locked in prison for something that you didn't do, I mean, that's sort of the ultimate threat to freedom. But then also kind of the unspoken loss of freedom, too, in that you are hesitant to pursue the freedoms that you are entitled to because of fear of, you know, what if I break the law in doing this? And, you know, it's particularly threatening to low-income folks. You mentioned the Hispanic population. Everybody is threatened by this. And so it's something that we are very optimistic as we move forward. It was one of those things during the short session as we talked about it. Many legislators told me we need to do this thoughtfully. This feels more like a long session kind of thing to get going. So we're optimistic in 2017 that we'll be able to move forward with some reforms in this area.
We've been talking with Becky Gray. She is Vice President for Outreach for the Locke Foundation. Thank you, Becky.
Sure.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.